forum about September 11th and terror. And I want to take about the first 20 minutes or so to put some thoughts out, some provocative thoughts, some various theses, some of which I agree with, some of which I myself disagree with and would not defend, and some of which I had no idea quite why I said them, but I thought I would say them. And again, it's for the sake of sparking discussion and our own thoughts and thinking about the issue of terror. And as we begin, in remembrance for those at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, for Afghanis and Iraqis, Israelis, Palestinians, U.S. and Canadian soldiers who have died, I would like to begin with a passage from the Book of Lamentations and have this as our prayer to God as we live in a situation of terror. This is from Lamentations chapter 3. God has filled me with bitterness. He has sated me with wormwood. He has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, gone is my glory and all that I had hoped for from the Lord. The thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. Amen. A few items to think about, and I'll put these on the board as well so that there may be some specifics you want to respond to. The first is a quotation from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Bonhoeffer writes, "Peace is the opposite of security." Wow. Which is something that we may not usually think about. Peace is the opposite of security. What I think that he's getting at with regard to our topic is something that the notions of terror and terrorism are political issues of security, not necessarily of peace. As we talk about security and as we talk about peace, I'd like to propose that perhaps we are talking about two very different things. And I think terror fits primarily under the notion of security. If I do a little kind of real short political philosophy, terror comes from the Latin word which simply means to frighten or to terrify. But it took on a specific political context and understanding during the French Revolution, when we talk about the reign of terror. And so terror now becomes something much more politically specific. than just to frighten or to terrify. And so, as I would try to give some, attempt to give a definition of terror, here's what I would say. I would say that terror is the use of violence and threats to intimidate or coerce for the purpose of the demoralization or submission of a government or political authority or group. Terror is the use of violence and threats to intimidate or coerce for the purpose of the demoralization or submission of a government or political authority or group. Second little thing I'd like to put up here. Terror is rational. People will again say that many of these terrorist acts or so on or so forth may be irrational and they seem to make no sense whatsoever. They are senseless. But indeed, if you follow someone like Hegel, again a 19th century German philosopher who lives after the French Revolution and reflects on it, he says that indeed terror is tremendously rational. Because it is rational because reason and rationality are always abstractions. And when you do things in the abstract, which is the way in which we reason, it is very easy to make terror rational. To give you an example of abstract reasoning, the old classic Aristotelian syllogism about logic. All human beings are mortal. Socrates is a human being. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Nice, straightforward syllogism, perfectly reasonable. You can engage in that same kind of abstract logic and reasoning to develop arguments for terror and why terror is the way in which your conduct is appropriate. Indeed, that's precisely what Robespierre and company did in the Reign of Terror. They were ultimately rational and reasonable about what they did. And that's why, to quote Hegel, they chopped off heads like so many cabbages. Perfectly reasonable. Third way of thinking. Most acts of terror try to be unprecedented. In other words, there is not some kind of precedence before that we can appeal to again to try to make sense of that. And that again is very purposeful. Because for something to be unprecedented means that it produces bafflement. To be unprecedented means that it undermines our security. It emphasizes our vulnerability. When something is what we might consider to be unprecedented, unique, totally different, we do not know how to act. And so therefore there is an inability to prepare ourselves for it, or to secure ourselves against it. And that is always one of the most frightening, right, things about terror. How could you prevent it? How could you secure yourself against it? It's unprecedented. Next, characterization of the terrorists. And I think the terrorists have been characterized in two ways. They've been characterized in a pathological way, and they've been characterized in terms of panopticonism, both of which I will explain. The pathological characterization of the terrorists, and for here, I'm heavily dependent upon Hannah Arendt and her way of thinking, and actually what she says about the way in which antisemitism works and the way one characterizes people that way. To characterize someone pathologically, and again here thinking about the rhetoric that has come out after September 11th, the two key phrases that I remember that would do this are when President Bush characterizes the axis of evil, or when he talks about terrorism as a cancer on freedom-loving people. Now think about that notion of terrorism as a cancer. Right? It's a pathology. But what happens when you pathologize people? If something is a pathology, if it's an illness, if it's a disease, what do you have to do?
Cure it.
Eradicate it. Right? Do we have some physicians? I know we have some physicians here, right? Ken, if I come in for an exam and you detect a lump, what are you going to do?
Do some tests.
And if those tests are there and it shows that that lump is a malignant cancer, a tumor, what are you going to do?
Offer you some options about treatment.
And the goal of it is, what do you want to do with that cancer?
Get rid of it.
Right? When you have that lump, your physician will not tell you, wow, this is your lucky day. What a beautiful, fortunate thing has happened to you. Right? When you have cancer, when something is pathological, it must be eliminated. You've got to get rid of it because there is something inherently wrong with them. And in fact, again, often as we would talk about that with regard to people, they must be subhuman or inhuman. And so that kind of virus, evil, cancer, disease on society, on the world, must be eradicated. That's the way we often talk about this. I think it's a very dangerous way of talking.
Michael, before you go to the next word, I have to find out if anyone in the room has any idea except you that what is meant by panopticonism.
Renita knows. The others are just...
have something to do with it.
No. This has been around since the mid-19th century. It's an architectural design.
Has something to do with the way of seeing?
Yes, it does. It does. And here again, I will say the two people that I'm dependent upon for this are the British philosopher, utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham, and then later here in contemporary times, French philosopher Michel Foucault. They both talk about the panopticon. The panopticon was a design by Bentham, and basically what it is, its specific design was a design for a prison. And if you've ever been in the prison in Joliet, Illinois, has anyone ever been in that? Right, you know, there's the big tower in the middle. I just think our fireside ring here is this big tower in the middle where the guards are, and then all around it are the cells. So it's a panopticon. The goal was, for the sake of efficiency, Bentham thought, look, you could put one guard or two guards in the tower, and only those, you know, all you needed were two guards, and they could watch all the prisoners around. Right? How efficient. And even better, those prisoners could be watched all the time, and they wouldn't even know whether they're being watched or not. So that panopticonism, pan is from the Greek meaning all or every, optics is seeing, so it is all seeing. It is a way of talking about surveillance. Panopticonism, that notion of all seeing, also seems to be one of the strategies now employed, whether that's trying to up security in terms of putting together the FBI and CIA and all that into kind of this super intelligence agency, or all the increased airport security or whatever, this sense of panopticonism, in order to look everywhere, to have the kind of surveillance to see if we can look everywhere to see if there are potential terrorists. And there, indeed, I think, is the pitfall of it, is that one of the presuppositions of panopticonism, since it's seeing everyone and everywhere, it makes no distinction between who is and who isn't a terrorist or a criminal. In other words, we are all potential terrorists. You may think Rabbi Marx is a nice, kindly, godly man and scholar. Stop. But a potential terrorist in our midst. He will go through airport security because you never know. As will all of us. The difficulties of crossing the borders from Canada and the US now, or wherever. This whole notion about somehow surveillance. If we could see everything, if we could see into everything, then we would be secure. And that's just one of the things I'd like us to think about. Does increased surveillance provide increased security? We all know increased surveillance in some respects implies loss of freedoms. That issue's come up too. But does this panopticonism provide what it should? A few more thoughts, and here I want to turn to some biblical thinking about this, and again to note that in some respects, terrorism, as we talk about it, given September 11th, is different than what one might want to call terror or terrorism in the scriptures. I think that would be perhaps somewhat anachronistic. But knowing that, let's make some of those analogies to see if it helps us think through some things. And again, I will go through this quickly. It seems to me that certain biblical situations where we can talk about terror and terrorism are found in places like the book of Jeremiah, the book of Daniel, and in the Gospels, a passage like Mark chapter 13, which is sometimes called the little apocalypse in Mark. And often apocalyptic literature, that kind of end-of-the-world literature, has a notion of terror with it and all the catastrophic and frightening events that are there, so that we can go with that. I will use as the example tonight Mark chapter 13. And Mark chapter 13 begins with the disciples sitting on the Mount of Olives admiring the temple and saying, what a great building and how wonderful, indeed, how huge the stones of the temple are. And we know as well that the temple was the key symbol for Judaism at that time. It is the religious center. It is the economic center. Indeed, one might even call it the military center because the Roman garrison is built right next to it. And so it is seen as the center and the legitimacy for the structure of life within Judaism at this time. And as the disciples are admiring that temple, Jesus responds with regard to saying, all these stones will be thrown down. There will not be left one stone upon another. And at that point, again, we may want to think of, you could picture, I mean, the thought of that to the disciples, I would say, is analogous to those pictures we have of the World Trade Center collapsing in on itself. To have said that before it ever happened would be unthinkable, or if you will, unprecedented. Who could ever imagine that? And of course, the disciples can't imagine that either. That Jesus, how could this be? Could this be possible? And more importantly, they ask, what are we to do? How could we respond to that kind of understanding? And Jesus' response to all of this, and I'm going to try to summarize it in one word because it's a word play throughout this. In English, again, it's translated in different ways. It's the Greek word blepo, blepane, which basically means watch. Now, watch here can go anything from see to perceive what is going on, to examine. To the word I like in all of this is discern. In the face of a situation of terror, Jesus' sage counsels, Jesus' advice. Again, we're not talking here about, you know, here's the rules, here's what you do, here's how you act. It's nothing that can be that cut and dry. But Jesus is talking about discernment. One needs to discern. And what is it that we are to discern? And again here, to toss out a few thoughts about that, to say what kind of, if you will, political discernment goes on if we read Mark chapter 13 from that point of view and ask it those kinds of questions with regard to political discernment. Here are some of the things that I think that chapter provides. That kind of political discernment that Jesus advises us on would say, avoid the temptation to seize power as a way of overthrowing the powers. Avoid the temptation to seize power as a way of overthrowing the powers. Secondly, I think Jesus says, watch against deception. There are a lot of ideologies out there. There are a lot of military mythologies out there. They will all be advocating, join us, do it my way, we are right. Watch out. They are deceivers. Jesus tells us, do not be alarmed. And politically, I would interpret that as saying, avoid precipitous action. Challenge the grounds upon which the various powers claim that you are necessarily obligated to join their action. Third, watch against triumphalism. I think that Jesus calls for, let me try one, Peter, just for you. A non-aligned radicalism. How's that? Which does not mean non-involvement. That I want to emphasize. But I think it's a notion of non-aligned. Watch against triumphalism. In this chapter, Jesus proposes non-violence, even if it culminates in suffering or death. It's not an escapist position, but Jesus asks us to endure in our logic of discernment and avoiding precipitous action. Positively speaking, what would it mean? I think it means that Jesus asks us to begin again. In other words, that if we use our death resurrection motifs as God continually calls us into new life, so here too again, we are called to always begin again. We are called to hope amid frustration. We are called to fidelity to God's promise rather than to human presumption. State it negatively again. I think the advice is do not recycle oppressive power into new hands. One of the few admonitions that says recycling is bad. Do not recycle oppressive power into new hands. And finally, as Jesus ends this chapter, another metaphor for this notion of watch, of keep watching, of discerning, is that sense of keep awake. Don't be lulled into sleep. Don't be lulled into complacency with whatever position might be here. My 3-sentence summary, and I will talk no more. As I look at Mark 13 from this political point of view and ask about this question of terrorism and living in a time of terror, I think what we hear Jesus advising us is saying, live in the politics of our times with eyes wide open. Look deeply and beyond the conflicting claims of those vying for power and deceptively promising security. Search out, discern, and resist the roots of violence, oppression, and domination, which hold all people hostages. Oppose triumphalism and keep watch with the human family throughout this dark night of suffering. It's your turn.
If you read the part of Mark 13 that is the root of those admonitions, would it take a long time?
Yes, I think so. I'll give you a few verses. Mark 13, chapter 5, verse 5. And this is again from the New Revised Standard Version. Verse 5, so this is the beginning of it all. Then Jesus began to say to them, beware that no one leads you astray. Or again in verse 9, as for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils and so on and so forth. And then the promise, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. Or again, the promise here, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And then again, I think a parable that he ends with that's very helpful here, beginning at verse 33. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey. When he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. So those would be some key passages. Please, bro.
I understand that the year of Jubilee passages that are in Scripture, that the year of Jubilee perhaps was never something that was practiced. I'm wondering if the apocalypse in Mark, do we have that document within Mark? It's just kind of been there waiting until terrorism broke loose, and then we say, now I have something to work on as a preacher. I didn't preach following September 11th. I retired September 1st. It was unfortunate that I didn't have a pastor to install the following Sunday. I don't think I would have sung God Bless America or the Battle Hymn of the Republic or I'm Glad to Be an American. I don't think I would have selected any of that. But September 11th, it just really left me essentially helpless. Now how do I preach? Now what do I preach? I've only been a bit of a politician all my life, so I better leave politics out. Okay. It's how do we preach after September 11th? I know that the texts I read now, I read differently. Mm-hmm. But it's a puzzle. It's not an easy thing. I've been preaching quite a bit the last few weeks in a church, but I don't preach on terrorism.
There's Karen, and then we'll go over here.
I think one of the things that's frustrated me about responses, and we've had in our church, we've had from time to time various discussion periods of people sharing. I'm beginning to read, well, first of all, a lot of times Christians, pacifists, whatever you call peacemakers, people that believe in nonviolence are considered to be naive and unrealistic, and you know, that's very nice to have a philosophy, but come on, you know, you can't, the world doesn't run that way, that kind of stuff. And yet, I read from time to time an editorial or an essay or an article or an op-ed of some kind of people in our country that have a response that makes sense. You know, I mean, it's the whole thing of you said something about don't let the terror turn you into a worse terror. I mean, there's a lot of ways to put that. And I'm frustrated because where are those voices? And who's reading them? And where's the critical mass? How's the critical mass going to be able to kind of blob together? Where are these little, how can these little pockets of voices that really, you know, I mean, I'm frustrated because I don't see our government hearing any of that. Or the leaders of our government that are. So, and then we talk about that a lot, how how do you get those little pockets of, it seemed to be, I don't want to use the word rational, because you just said terror was rational.
Please.
The words of our 8-year-old son were to pray for our enemies when that happened. Mm-hmm. The sermon by our pastor on the 16th, were instead of tax collector, replace terrorist, and how would Jesus be treated or observed or talked about behind his back if he sat down at table with terrorists? But that's what he did. That's who he was with. He wasn't with people of his kind, people that that were high social standing, that liked what was going on. He was with the ones that people hated. And he told us those are who we are supposed to reach out to. I think that's our only reaction and our only course of action we can take.
Others.
But it wasn't, obviously, it wasn't the course of action.
Oh, no.
That we took.
It seems like then, I mean, that's not the course we took, but the question comes back to then what do we do? How do we, you know, come together as a country to tell our leaders that, you know, we don't want to do this. This is not what we should be doing, or at least to be heard. I mean, I don't know how to, you know, there's a lot of people in the country that think everything is being done exactly what it should be. Without getting division within the country, or country itself, I mean, how do you go about that?
I think the problem is that we are so divided within ourselves. I believe that the source of terrorism is the lack of concern about many people. At the same time, I also believe there were many innocent people killed by no fault of their own. And I can go back and forth and back and forth, and my two feelings and beliefs and frustrations are at war in themselves. So it's difficult to say, this is it. I mean, I can remember when our kids were little, we didn't spank them because you don't teach a child to be nonviolent, to not hit by hitting them. By the same token, we didn't allow them to do whatever was being harmful to somebody else. So we had to find an alternative way to teach what they couldn't do. And I think we don't know what that alternative way is. We don't know how to do this. It's just, it's so big. We know we need to help the individuals who are being hurt on both sides, and we just haven't found a medium to do that.
others? Do you know what the alternative is?
Well, I just feel like, this isn't an answer to anything. I just sometimes feel like most of life is a choice between an earthquake or a tornado. And I mean, really, I can't find the good and the bad. I mean, it's, do I want to stick with the tornado? Or do I want to go with the earthquake? Do I want to just take a hurricane? I don't know, and that sounds stupid, but I just, you know, I'm kind of like you, just totally at war with what in myself, what in the world is, and I don't see a peaceful, I mean, not peace, but it's going to be a tornado, it seems for me, or an earthquake, or whatever. I just
I've been intrigued since you wrote it up there that the top line, peace is the opposite of security. I've been kind of bouncing around with that for a while. The question came from the back about you want to do something. And it seems that so many of our actions, our nation's actions, are clearly are directed towards the security side of things. Developing the Department of Homeland Security, you know, and there's a part of me that would just that understands that completely. I would just like to be secure with my kids, and so forth. But remembering Rabbi Marx's message the other night at Vespers, peace leads in a different way. And instead of looking at the things that give us the illusion of security, if we ask the questions, what led to this, feeling the pain from the other side that caused it, that might be some beginning steps towards peace, instead of towards the illusion of security.
I think partly we have a lot of, our government feels like we have the right to do whatever because of what happened here. And that, I mean, we've taken it so far that, you know, our government has decided we don't like Arafat. We think he's an unfit ruler. You know, we've gone through deciding who should rule in other countries. And I think we're taking big leaps towards things that are inappropriate.
And in fact, in my opinion, a lot of the things that have been done in the name of security have not done anything to add to the column of security and have meant to detract from the column of the rights of human beings in this country and abroad. Arafat as one. The civilians we killed in Afghanistan as another, and a few other countries that we know a little bit about now, and some countries where people are getting killed, and we won't find out about that maybe for another 20 years. What is our country doing in our names that we don't know about in and under the umbrella of increasing our security, which is a wonderful marketing ploy because people want to be secure. We want our security to be expensive, the security of other countries.